So we're delighted to have with us today Dominic Stratham from Creation Ministries, and he's going to address us, and there'll be a time for questions at the end, so you'll have an opportunity then to come forward with your questions.
Ben and I are representing the Christian organisation Creation Ministries International, and we seek to uphold the Bible from the very first verse. We are primarily an information ministry, providing people in the church with tools and information with which they can defend the Christian faith. We want to encourage Christians to hold fast to the Bible as the Word of God. And also we want to help equip the church to reach out to a fallen and lost world. And we're here today to make it clear that when it comes to science, Bible-believing Christians are not in difficulties, and that the Bible is a book that can be trusted. Now, if you'd like to know more about our ministry and would like to receive our free InfoBytes email, then in just a moment, Ben's going to pass around some clipboards so that you can sign up for this if you'd like to. InfoBytes will enable you to read our responses to the latest media stories about science and the Bible and creation and evolution. This is an example of one news item we had quite recently, answering the question, is teaching creation child abuse, as some have suggested? Here's another about how embracing evolutionary beliefs sometimes turns pastors into atheists. And I can assure you, it does happen. This one responds to a claim by National Geographic magazine that creationists are at war with science. Well, we're not. That's simply nonsense. Oh dear, got the slides mixed up. Okay, so if you'd like to receive our free InfoBytes email, please do pop your details down on the form. If you do that, we would like to give you an assurance that we will not pass those details on to anybody else. Okay, while the clipboards are going round, I would like to mention our website. The web address is very easy to remember, creation.com. There's a search engine there in the top right-hand corner, and this enables people to enter keywords representing any question that they might have about the Bible and science and creation and evolution. There are around 10,000 articles on the website dealing with all sorts of questions relating to these issues. On creation.com, you'll also find Parents' Corner, which supports those involved in homeschooling and also other parents keen to help their children learn about creation. Okay, well, the talk this morning, or the first talk today, Different Races or One Human Family. And this talk is about the history of mankind as taught in the Bible, and why this is so important. You know, if the Bible can't be trusted in what it has to say about our origins, where we all came from, then why should anybody think that it can be trusted in anything else it has to say? And if the Bible's not correct in what it teaches about our history, why should anyone believe that it's correct in what it has to say about God, or about morality, or about sin and salvation? And you know, if Darwin's theory of evolution is true, then let's face it, the Bible is wrong about some pretty fundamental issues. For example, if evolution is true, then death is not the result of sin, as the Bible teaches, because according to the theory of evolution, disease and violence and suffering and death were all in the world long before anybody was around to sin. And if evolution is true, then surely even the character of God comes into question. According to the Bible, the world that God originally created was perfect, one that reflected the perfectly good nature of its creator. And the Bible makes clear that in that world, in the world that God originally made, there would have been no suffering or death. People would not have died, and animals would not have eaten each other. In Genesis chapter 1, God said, "And to every beast of the earth, and to every fowl of the air, and to everything that creepeth upon the earth, wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for meat. And it was so. In the world that God originally created, animals did not eat each other. They ate plants. But if evolution is true, then suffering and death were part of life from the beginning. In fact, according to Darwin's theory, human life came into being through suffering, through natural selection and survival of only the fittest. And you know, despite the Bible's clear statement that God made the first man specially and supernaturally from the dust of the earth, some teach that God used evolution to create people. They say that God created humanity through a process of millions of years of natural selection, through millions of years of disease and predation, through nature red in tooth and claw, and through survival of only the fittest. But why should a loving and all-powerful God create through such a violent and wasteful process? And what sort of a God would create in such a way? The non-Christian philosopher of science, Professor David Hull, wrote this: "Whatever the God implied by evolutionary theory may be like, he is not the Protestant God of waste not, want not. He is also not a loving God who cares about his productions. He is not even the awful God portrayed in the book of Job. The God of evolution by natural selection is careless, wasteful, indifferent, almost diabolical. He is certainly not the sort of God to whom anyone would be inclined to pray. The God of theistic evolutionists, that's people who teach that God created through evolution, is surely not the God of the Bible. The God of the Bible created a perfect world, not through an evolutionary process, but supernaturally. And according to the Bible, it is only the violent and desperately unhappy place that it is today because of our sin, because we turned away from God and embraced evil. That's the Bible's explanation for why the world is as it is today. But of course, the Bible also gives us the good news, doesn't it? That God didn't want us to remain in this state. He sent his Son, Jesus Christ, into the world to die on the cross so that our sins could be forgiven. And after Christ had died to pay the penalty for sin, God raised him from the dead so that all who would follow him might be empowered to live a new life and one that's pleasing to God. And Jesus said that one day he would return and that he would restore the world to its original perfect form. And he's promised for all who will receive his salvation that there would then be no more suffering and no more death, which is why it's the good news. And what we believe about our origins will not only affect how we view God, but also how we view one another. And the way we think about people will be greatly influenced by what glasses we wear, whether we see the world through secular evolutionary glasses or through biblical glasses. Belief in evolution will lead to a very different understanding of people to a belief in biblical creation. Now, according to the Bible, the whole of humanity is descended from one man, from Adam. In his address to the Athenians, the Apostle Paul said this: "And God made of one blood all nations of men, for to dwell on all the face of the earth." The Bible also tells us that we all came from one woman, too. In Genesis chapter 3, we read that Adam called his wife's name Eve because she was the mother of all the living. And in this slide, we can see what is essentially the biblical account of early human history. God made Adam and Eve, who had a number of sons and daughters. And from these, the original human population grew up. Then, around 1600 years after creation, due to all the sin and violence in the world, God judged mankind through a global flood, which only Noah and his family survived. So according to the Bible, all the people on the earth today are descended from Noah's family, that is, the three sons of Noah and their wives. Then, following mankind's rebellion against God at Babel, God confused their languages and scattered them over the face of the earth. Which is why we now have different people groups in different parts of the world speaking fundamentally different languages. The Bible then teaches that we are one human family. There aren't many different human races. There's just one human race, the people descended from Adam. So in biblical thinking, there's no place for racism. How can there be, if there's only one human race? And it is this biblical account of creation and early human history which surely provides the final solution to the problem of racism. Now, in the evolutionary view, people, of course, are little more than glorified apes. Over the last 5 or 6 million years, we're told, ape-like creatures evolved into people. Now, Charles Darwin was in many ways a Victorian gentleman. He abhorred slavery and actually gave regularly to missionary causes. But his evolutionary beliefs led to him having a dark side, and he was explicitly racist. Darwin believed that people throughout the world are different because they evolved separately from apes, or ape-like creatures that lived millions of years ago. The Australoids of Australia, the Negroids of Africa, the Mongoloids of Asia, and the Caucasoids of Europe all evolved separately, he believed. Darwin also believed that some of these different human races, as he saw them, had evolved more than others. And although he didn't advocate the extermination of dark-skinned people, he did predict, based on his theory, that the superior, more evolved white races, as he saw them, would replace the inferior, less evolved black races, as he saw them. He wrote in his book, The Descent of Man, that the civilized races of man will almost certainly exterminate and replace the savage races throughout the world. Now, I dare say it grieves you that anybody could have said such things. But he did say them, and many people accepted his argument. The Harvard University historian of science, Professor Stephen Jay Gould, wrote this: "Biological arguments for racism may have been common before 1850, but they increased by orders of magnitude following acceptance of evolutionary theory." On the more benign side, although still shocking, it led to bizarre activities, such as an African being put on display at a zoo as an example of a creature supposedly part way between apes and humans. The man was Otabenga. He was brought from the Belgian Congo and put on display at St. Louis, Missouri in 1904. On the more sinister side, it led to Australian Aboriginals being shot to provide skull specimens for museums. that is, specimens of supposedly partly evolved humans. The theory of evolution was also accepted by some in the church, with equally shocking consequences. For example, the Reverend Charles Kingsley, who was a great supporter of Darwin and his theory, wrote this: "The black people of Australia, exactly the same race as the African Negro, cannot take in the gospel. All attempts to bring them to a knowledge of the true God have as yet failed utterly. Poor brutes in human shape, they must perish off the face of the earth like brute beasts." Well, the Reverend Kingsley would have done better to acquire his understanding of people from the Bible rather than from Charles Darwin. Ernst Haeckel was a professor of zoology at the University of Jena in Germany, and he was one of Darwin's greatest supporters in Europe. And in his zeal to promote Darwinism, Haeckel even forged drawings of embryos in order to try to persuade people of the truth of evolution. Now, Haeckel taught that humans pass through the different stages of evolution during the course of their embryonic development, when they're in their mother's womb. Now, according to Darwin's theory, you know, we all evolved from fish. So if we were to trace back our family tree far enough, each one of us would come to a fish. And you can see here how Haeckel's drawings of the embryos of fish, salamanders, chickens and humans all look very similar at this stage of development. Haeckel called this his theory of embryonic recapitulation, based on the idea that our embryonic development retraces or recapitulates our evolutionary development. And historically, Haeckel's theory has been used to support abortion. You see, people were told that aborting a fetus at an early stage was no different to aborting a fish. And many people accepted that and went ahead with the termination. But you know, real embryos look like this. This is the embryo of a fish. This is a salamander, it's a chicken, and that's a human, all at the same stage of development, what they call the tailbud stage. You know, modern embryologists, some of them, some professors of embryology, will now openly admit that Haeckel's drawings were deliberate forgeries. If you go for Google Images and you look up Ernst Haeckel, you will see that he was an absolutely first-rate artist. There's no possibility that this was any kind of mistake. In one of his books, Professor Haeckel wrote, "If one must draw a sharp boundary between the higher mammals, it has to be drawn between the most highly developed and civilized man on the one hand and the rudest savages on the other. And the latter have to be classed with the animals." This is what the theory of evolution led to. He went on. "Thus, for example, a great English traveller who lived for a considerable time on the west coast of Africa says, 'I consider the Negro to be a lower species of man and cannot make up my mind to look upon him as a man and a brother.' For the gorilla will then also have to be admitted into the family." This was one of Germany's top 19th century intellectuals. His ignorance beggars belief. Friedrich Ratzel was another prominent German Darwinist, and he developed the theory of Lebensraum, which is German for living space. Just as more successful animals displace less successful animals, he taught, it was natural in the struggle for space and the struggle for life for stronger human races to displace weaker human races. And both Haeckel and Ratzel were very influential in promoting social Darwinism, the idea that survival of the fittest applies to humans and nations, just as it applies to animals in the jungle. Even the German Emperor, Kaiser Wilhelm II, had been persuaded of this view. He wrote, rise of Japan following their military victories over China in 1895, and he wrote this. He said, I foresee in the future a fight for life and death between the white and the yellow for their sheer existence. That's social Darwinism, that is. This doctrine of Lebensraum was sometimes applied very rigorously in the German colonies, and nowhere more so than in German West Africa. And in the early part of the 20th century, German soldiers systematically slaughtered the indigenous African peoples, even driving whole groups into the desert, where they died from heat and thirst. Speaking of these people, the American president, Woodrow Wilson, wrote that Germany's imperial interest had not been the development of these African people, but their extermination. And many of the senior soldiers and so-called racial scientists who were at the forefront of German policy in West Africa went on to play leading roles in the rise of the Nazi Party. The surgeon and anthropologist Professor Arthur Keith echoed the understanding of many when he wrote of Adolf Hitler, the German Führer, as I have consistently maintained, is an evolutionist. He has consciously sought to make the practice of Germany conform to the theory of evolution. Hitler himself declared at a Nazi party rally in 1933, higher race subjects to itself a lower race, a right that we see in nature. Well, you might be saying, okay, but all this is just a part of history. But I can assure you that evolutionary racism is alive and well today. The co-discoverer of the structure of DNA, James Watson, wrote this. There's no firm reason to anticipate that the intellectual capacities of peoples geographically separated in their evolution should prove to have evolved identically. That is evolutionary racism, alive and well, in the words of one of the world's leading scientists. Well, as I've already argued, the answer to all this is the biblical doctrine of creation. If we're all descended from Adam, there's no basis for racism, because there's only one human race, and we're all part of one human family. And you know, recent scientific research in the area of genetics has confirmed this. Don't let anyone tell you that the Bible and science are in conflict, because it's simply not the case. Now, the part of our DNA known as the Y chromosome is passed from father to son. Okay? Women don't have a Y chromosome. And secular geneticists, that's geneticists who would make no profession of Christian faith, secular geneticists have gone all around the world sampling men's Y chromosomes. And they've come to the conclusion that the whole of humanity is descended from one man. I kid you not. They've given him the name Y chromosomal Adam. Not because they believe in Adam and Eve, of course. But it does seem a rather good name, doesn't it, if you're a biblical creationist? Now, the part of our DNA known as mitochondrial DNA is inherited just from the mother. Okay? Both men and women have mitochondrial DNA, but you just get it from your mum. And secular geneticists, that's geneticists who would make no profession of Christian faith, secular geneticists have gone all around the world sampling people's mitochondrial DNA. And they've come to the conclusion that the whole of humanity is descended from one woman. They've given her the name Mitochondrial Eve. Not because they believe in Adam and Eve, of course, but it does seem a rather good name, doesn't it, if you're a biblical creationist. Now, all this fits the biblical account of creation rather well. In fact, it was a scientifically testable prediction of the biblical account of creation. But it was never a prediction of evolutionary theory. And evolutionists have to jump through hoops in order to make these facts fit within their story. You see, they have to argue that there was a population bottleneck. That's where the number of people on the earth dropped down to a very low number for quite a few generations, so that all the lines except that descended from Y chromosomal Adam died out. And they have to argue that it happened a second time as well. Another population bottleneck, where the number of people on the earth dropped down to a very low number for quite a few generations, so that all the lines except that descended from mitochondrial Eve died out. It's a big stretch. And actually, it's a massive headache for them. Because when populations drop down to such a low number, there's a lot of inbreeding. And that causes a lot of damage to the genome. That sort of thing has even been seen to make animal species go extinct. So they have a big problem. Now, you've probably been told that humans share 99% of their DNA with chimps, and that this supports the evolutionary belief that we share a common ancestor. Well, did you know that we share 50% of our DNA with bananas? And let's face it, we're not half banana. So even if we did share 99% of our DNA with chimps, that would not make us 99% chimp. And in fact, this 99% figure is a very old one. And I've even come across secular papers, scientific papers, that have put the similarity as low as 81%. It all depends, really, how you measure it. Well, where did all the so-called human races come from? I mean, if all humanity is descended from one man, where did all the people groups come from? And how did we get dark-skinned people and light-skinned people? Well, this is an article from our Creation magazine, and it features two lovely twin girls. One with blue eyes and light skin, and the other with brown eyes and brown skin. And here are mum and dad, and here they are as a family. Two mum and dad, two medium brown skin people. Personally, I think Adam and Eve probably had their skin colour. This medium brown. I believe that Adam and Eve, God created Adam and Eve with all the potential, all the genetic information needed to produce all the different people groups we find on the earth today. Here they are a few years on. And can you see the one on the left? She's not just light-skinned, she's European-looking. And the one on the right, she's not just dark-skinned, she's African-looking. In another issue of our Creation magazine, we feature two lifelong friends, Bill Culbra and George Snow Wilson. And Bill and George became friends in 1964 when they served together in the Australian Army. And years later, when Bill was suffering from kidney failure, George was able to give him one of his kidneys. Now, in order for kidney transplants to be successful, there has to be a close match between the donor's and the recipient's tissues. Why then, if the evolutionary lines of Bill and George separated many thousands of years ago, as evolutionists tell us, was the cluster such a close match between Bill's and George's tissues? And you know, this is no isolated example, made clear by this article in Discover magazine. They wrote, the genetic unity of all people on the planet means, for instance, that white Americans can sometimes be better tissue matches for black Americans than are other black Americans. Let me read that again. White Americans can sometimes be better tissue matches for black Americans than are other black Americans. And of course, vice versa. This is so significant. This means that in some ways, I am probably more like some dark-skinned people than I am some light-skinned people. You see, there aren't different races. There's just one human family, as the Bible teaches. Now, for many years, some people in the church taught that dark skin is due to a curse. How many people have heard that idea? Yeah, dark skin is due to a curse. Yeah, thank you. Now, you remember the day that Noah got drunk and lay naked in his tent? And because his son Ham was disrespectful to him, Noah spoke a curse over Ham's son Canaan. This is it. Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren. Okay, now the argument goes something like this. The name Ham means burnt, as in sunburnt. And following Ham's disrespectful behaviour towards his father, Noah spoke this curse which led to a nation of dark-skinned people. Okay? Now you might think this is ridiculous, which it is, but as I understand it, this view is still fairly widely held in some parts of the world. Okay? But it simply doesn't stand up to scrutiny. Firstly, if Ham was given the name Ham, burnt or sunburnt, because this was his skin colour, then surely he must have had that skin colour when he was born, which was before the curse was spoken. Secondly, the curse was spoken over Canaan anyway, not Ham. Cursed be Canaan, it says, a servant of servants shall he be to his brethren. Now Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham and Japheth. Ham had four sons, Cush, Mizraim, Put and Canaan. Cush, Mizraim and Put went to live in Africa, we're told. And black Africans may well be descended from one of them, probably from Cush, who is said to have gone to live in Ethiopia. But Canaan went to live in the land we now know of as Israel, and in all probability had fairer skin. And the curse was spoken over him, the one who in all likelihood had the fairer skin. So there's absolutely no basis for arguing that dark skin is due to a curse. In fact, dark skin can be a blessing. Dark skin protects against cancer, skin cancer, in sunny regions, and also protects against other skin diseases which are common in tropical climates. Light skin can also be a blessing. We need sunlight for our bodies to produce vitamin D so that we can have healthy bones. And in regions where there's not very much sunlight, places like Scandinavia, it's an advantage to have light skin, because too dark a skin would result in insufficient vitamin D production and unhealthy bones. There are, in fact, all shades of skin colour, and it has nothing to do with evolution and nothing to do with the alleged curse upon Ham. It's really about how much of the pigment melanin that we produce in our skin cells. If you produce lots of melanin, you'll have dark skin. If you produce less melanin, you'll have lighter skin. And of course, all shades in between. Interestingly, there are the same number of pigment-forming cells in Caucasian and Negroid skin. Okay, so I have the same number of pigment-forming cells in my skin as the darkest people from Africa. It's just a matter of how much melanin is produced in those skin cells. And some people are less developed than others in that they're less organized, they have less technology and so on. But it's not because they are less evolved. Now, as a young man, Charles Darwin traveled the world. And one of his stops was a place called Tierra del Fuego, right there at the southern tip of South America. And here, he came across some Fuegians, who he came to regard as examples of significantly less evolved humans. He wrote of them, "I could not have believed how wide was the difference between savage and civilized man. It is greater than between a wild and domesticated animal. Viewing such men, one can hardly make oneself believe that they are fellow creatures." Darwin also said of their language that it scarcely deserves to be called articulate, and that the cries of domestic animals are far more intelligible. But he could not have been more wrong. The reality is that the Fuegian's language was much richer and more descriptive than English. A first attempt at a Fuegian dictionary contained 32,000 words and inflections. They had 5 different words to describe different types of snow, and more than 50 different words to describe family relationships. So on that basis, you'd have to conclude that they were more evolved than the British, wouldn't you? If you're going to use language as your criterion. And this fits the biblical view that the Fuegians of the 19th century had become savage from a higher level. Okay, now you see the difference between the evolutionary view and the biblical view. In the evolutionary view, some have come up more. They've evolved more than others. In the biblical view, some have come down more. They've degenerated more than others. But this kind of degeneration doesn't change people's fundamental natures, which means that given the right conditions, people can come back up again, because they're made in the image of God. And I believe that Christianity provides those conditions. I firmly believe that. And that's the subject for another talk. Now, according to Professor Richard Dawkins, this is what evolution tells us about ourselves. According to Dawkins, Darwin's theory of evolution shows that we are no more than survival mechanisms, robot vehicles blindly programmed to preserve the selfish molecules known as genes. According to Dawkins, evolution shows that we are no more than biochemical robots. We just do, you know, what the chemical reactions in our bodies prompt us to do. According to Dawkins, all our thoughts, feelings and choices are not driven by a mind or a soul, but simply by biochemistry going on inside us. Professor Anthony Cashmore of the University of Pennsylvania would agree with him. According to Cashmore, Darwin's theory shows that not only do we have no more free will than a fly or a bacterium, in actuality, we have no more free will than a bowl of sugar. Can you imagine what it would be like if people really believed this? Can you imagine a society where people behave as if this were true? A society where people act as if they're not responsible for what they do. Which is what really, you know, what this man is saying. And you know, this is being taught to our youngsters in the universities as science. Frankly, I think I'd struggle to think of a more damaging doctrine with which to raise the up-and-coming generation. You know, the creation-evolution debate is no side issue. It really matters what we believe about where we came from. The religious studies scholar Professor Houston Smith wrote this: Martin Lings is probably right in saying that more cases of loss of religion are to be traced to the theory of evolution than to anything else. Mark Carhill is an evangelist who has spent many years sharing Christ with students across the United States. And he said this: the number one answer I get for there not being a God is evolution. Well, if you're thinking, that's probably just America. Well, what about Andy Banton, who's General Secretary of the Open Air Mission here in the UK? He wrote, the number one objection to the Christian message that we hear over and over is the theory of evolution. But the good news is that there's absolutely no reason for our youngsters to lose their confidence in the Bible. Over the last 20 years or so, creation scientists have done a lot of really good work. And more we have the answers. More and more we can demonstrate that the known facts of science fit the biblical account of creation and earth history far better than they fit the evolution story. And the Bible-believing Christians have nothing to be afraid of from science. Now, the Apostle Peter counseled us, be ready always to give an answer to every man that asketh you a reason of the hope that is in you. And at Creation Ministries International, we seek to help people build a sound, defensible, biblical worldview. We show how Christian doctrine is built upon the foundations of historical events recorded in Genesis, and how these are supported rather than undermined by the facts of science. A few years ago, I met a Christian head teacher at a state school, a secular school in Spain. And he told me why he had become involved in the creation ministry. And it was this. He said he started to realise how hard it could be for the youngsters coming from Christian families when their science teachers argued so strongly that science had disproved the Bible. He told me how he came to see the inner turmoil of some of these kids as they really struggled when they didn't have the answers. It can be tough out there, you know, for the kids. Very tough. And it can be tougher in the universities. Some of their professors have every intention of tearing their faith to pieces. And this is one of the reasons we produce Creation Magazine. It's to give people the answers. There's no need for Christians to struggle in this area. Science has not disproved the Bible, and it is not difficult to demonstrate this. And that's what we do in article after article in this magazine. Creation Magazine's been around for about 40 years. It's distributed now in over 100 countries. It comes out quarterly, 4 issues per year, and it's in full colour. There are often articles, or sometimes articles, responding to the latest pronouncements by people like Richard Dawkins. I can assure you that at Creation Ministries International, we are not the slightest bit intimidated by this man. We just wait for him to make his latest gaffe, and then we write about it. And I can assure you, he makes plenty of them. This is an article I wrote about an ancient clay tablet that confirms the biblical account of a global flood. There are often articles about astronomy and how the evidence from astronomy supports what the Bible teaches about a recent creation. Anyone ever told you that before? There's plenty of evidence from astronomy supporting what the Bible teaches about a recent creation. Let me give you an example. Did you know that the moon is constantly moving away from the Earth? This time next year, the moon will be about 4 centimetres further away from the Earth than it is today. If the moon had really been orbiting the Earth for all the billions of years they say, it would now be far further away from the Earth than it is. And there are many facts like that from astronomy supporting what the Bible teaches about a recent creation. This is an article which explains how Christian beliefs laid the foundations for modern science in the 16th and 17th centuries. Did you know that there are leading secular historians of science who will acknowledge that the modern scientific revolution arose in a large part out of the Christian belief in creation? Almost to a man, the founders of modern science were Bible-believing creationists, and they would write about how their belief in creation and their belief in the God of the Bible inspired them to do their scientific work. You see, the Bible teaches that the universe was designed by God. And if it was designed, and if it behaved consistently from one day to the next, just as God is consistent, and if it was made by a rational God, then one might expect, if it was made by a lawgiver, one might expect there even to be laws of nature. And they looked for those laws and they found them, and it birthed modern science. You know, the secularists argue that if we teach creation in schools, it will hamper the youngsters' ability to learn science. It's nonsense. Science arose out of a belief that the universe had been created by a God who behaved consistently from one day to the next and had designed it and so that it could be understood. Creation Magazine, the family magazine, is always a central section for the youngsters. I believe it's true to say that we've had more life-changing testimonies from Creation Magazine than from any of our other materials. And I've got a couple of quotes here. Rod Walsh is one of our speakers in Australia. He told us this after one of his meetings. He said, 3 people came up to me after the message and told me that Creation Magazine was responsible for their conversion to Christ. I've got another testimony here from Peter L., aged 12. He wrote into our office, "Your magazine is great. As soon as it comes through the door, the wrapper comes off and I'm reading it. I wish it came more often." A wonderful testimony from a young lad of 12. Well, if you'd like to subscribe, we have actually got a special offer on. If you subscribe today for 1 year, you can take away a free back issue. Start reading it today. If you subscribe for 3 years, you can take away a free back issue and also a free DVD. And there are the free creation DVD, and there are a number to choose from. This, I think, is a particularly good offer. You can now read Creation magazine digitally on your smartphone, your iPad, your laptop, that sort of thing. And for just an extra £3 a year on top of the subscription, it can be accessed on up to 5 different devices. So 5 members of the family could read it on their e-device. Ben's going to pass around some clipboards now for those who would like to subscribe. If you do subscribe, please do see Ben at the back and pay. Otherwise, you don't get your free gifts. You see, you can subscribe online if you want to later, but if you do that, there are no free gifts. While the clipboards are going round, I would like to remind you, if I may, about the website. The web address is very easy to remember, creation.com. Remember the search engine there in the top right-hand corner. If you're sharing Christ with somebody next week, a member of the family, next-door neighbour, someone at work, and they raise a supposedly scientific objection to the Bible, and you don't know the answer, get onto creation.com, enter keywords representing that question or that objection into the search engine there, you're very likely to come across an article that will give you the answer. You can then read the article and tell them the answer, or you could just email them the link. You can also download our app, creation.mobi. It's completely free. If you don't know how to do that, don't ask me. Just have a word with somebody over the age of about 6, and they should be able to help you out. Okay. I don't think I've mentioned the Creation Answers book. If you're thinking of taking away just one resource from the book tables, I would recommend you consider this one. It answers the most commonly asked questions about the Bible and science. And I think probably more than any other book, this one demonstrates that Bible-believing Christians really have nothing to be afraid of from science. There's no conflict between the Bible and science. This one I'm particularly keen on. It's just been published. It's written for teens around the 15 to 18 age group. And it gets across the creation message within the context of a particularly gripping story. Now, it's set in a boys' boarding school, so it's a little bit rough in places, but we think most Christian parents would be comfortable with the content. There are very few resources for teens, and this is a particularly good one. So if you know a teenager, you know, who's possibly struggling, you know, with some of the atheistic and evolutionary indoctrination that they're getting through the TV or at school, very often it comes from school, and you'd like to be able to help them, a gift of this book would go a long way to doing that. It's gripping, it's engaging, they'll get into the story, and at the same time, they'll be given lots of good information supporting a Christian worldview and a belief in creation. And if you do buy it, please do get it from us, because there is a previous version out that we wouldn't recommend. Another excellent book, One Human Family, by Dr. Carl Wieland. I describe it as the definitive understanding of race from a biblical perspective.